really is, and bring in Robin. Okay, so Kendall is going to take a moment just to rename all of you. It looks like we almost got that done, not quite. Justice Mole, you are muted. And Justice Stegner, you are muted. You can all unmute. Okay, Chief, it looks like we're ready to go, and we are at this time recording.
Very well. I'd like to thank everyone for accommodating the first Idaho Zoom Supreme Court hearing. As such, welcome you all from distant shores. I'd like to announce the first case of Fisk versus McDonald and Northwest Specialty Hospital. On behalf of the appellants, Fisk, Gary Shockey will argue and Dennis Wilkinson will appear only. On behalf of the respondent, Dr. Jeffrey McDonald, Michael Ramsden will argue. And on behalf of North Idaho Day Surgery LLC, Nancy Jo Garrett will argue. Ms. Garrett and Mr. Ramsden, have you decided your time in this regard?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well.
15 and 15.
Excuse me, sir?
15 and 15.
Very good. Everyone can see the timer. Counsel?
This is Gary Shockey. I do not see the timer on my screen, but I'm not certain that that's going to be critical to me because I have a clock right on my computer screen of my own.
Very well. If you will look down right below Michael Ramsden on our view, that has the official time kept by the clerk. Do you see that?
I do not, but again, I'm not going to have any sort of issue or complaint about that, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. At this time, we will keep you apprised as you are approaching your limit, Mr. Shockey. Are there any other matters before the court of a preliminary nature prior to oral argument?
Your Honor, this is Nancy Garrett, and I cannot see the timer unless I delete one of the parties or justices.
All right. At this point in time, I will ask the clerk that you will give oral notification 2 minutes prior to each party's time running out. They're allotted time running out. Is that all right, Madam Clerk?
Yes, I can do that.
Counsel?
Thank you very much.
That's great, Your Honor.
Very well. At this point in time, on behalf of the appellant, Fisk, Mr. Shockey, we will hear you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice Burdick, and the rest of the justices. I'm grateful for an opportunity to make my presentation in this fashion, although I have to admit I feel a little awkward about it, and will do my best in the context of how we're working here. I hope not to miss much or anything. This is an appeal from dismissal of our medical malpractice case on behalf of Kelly Fisk, Mrs. Fisk. And as I'm sure the court has gleaned from both the briefs filed by everyone and perhaps a look into part of the record, we have a very extensive record and a very extensive amount of arguments. To begin with, I would like to ask that actually propose that one way that we should be looking at everything overall in this matter, and as the court reviews appellant's filings in this case and reviews the reports and declarations of our expert witnesses, that we ask the overall question of how much admissible evidence did the appellants provide to the trial court on the issue of what is the local standard and how was the local standard violated. And I think if we keep that in the back of our minds as the overriding global question, then that helps to understand why we assert appellants have provided almost exclusively all the admissible evidence that would go both to the summary judgment motion and ultimately at trial. I make those comments based on the decision in, and I always have trouble with the pronunciation, Suhadolnik, I think it is, of some years ago, which said that on a motion for summary judgment in this context, that both sides have the obligation, initially the moving party being the appellees or defendants in this case, have the obligation to come forward to the court with admissible evidence on the knowledge of the expert witnesses and of the local standard of care. We assert, and the record, I believe, confirms that as movants, neither the hospital nor Dr. McDonald came forward with any admissible evidence on the subject of what the standard is, the local standard of care involved in this case. There's only one statement in the declarations and filings of the appellants about the local standard of care, and that one statement was from one of their experts, which said that the local standard of care is what was done in this case. And that is hardly sufficient in appellant's view to establish that they have come forward with admissible evidence of what the local standard of care was. We, on the other hand, and I'll detail quite a bit of this later, have provided massive amounts of admissible evidence from our experts about what the local standard of care was. I'm sure that the court is very familiar with the facts by having reviewed the case, but I'd like to emphasize just a very few facts. Mrs. Fisk, if it isn't appropriate for me to speak to my client by her first name. Mrs. Fisk went into Northwest Specialty Hospital on October 10 of 2015 for a relatively routine cervical fusion. She went through the process. Dr. McDonald performed the surgery, and we have made no criticisms of Dr. McDonald's performance of the surgery. She spent the night at Northwest Specialty, and the next day, as she's getting ready to be discharged mid-morning to late morning, she starts experiencing some fairly severe abdominal pain and abdominal stress. By 3 p.m., she was throwing up and had more severe abdominal pain. By 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., she was much worse. By 1:26 in the morning, she was saying she felt like she was going to die. And by 3 o'clock in the morning, she was, again, even worse. And as you can imagine, against that background, a number of things are going on. Nursing care is being provided, but in our view and in the opinions and evidence from our experts, insufficient and inadequate nursing care being provided through that time. And a key player in the events here is nurse practitioner Jessica Schultz, who was the employee of and nurse practitioner for Dr. McDonald. And
Mr. Shockey, was she the employee of Dr. McDonald, or was she the employee of the corporation, the Neurosurgical Corporation?
That's unclear. Still, we asked over and over for more information and detail. The actual employment agreement was never provided. What we do have and what we've submitted to the court is the letter from Dr. McDonald offering her the job and some of the terms of the job, and those terms and that offer and that letter are very well and adequately summarized in our pleadings. We take the position, of course, that it doesn't matter, because in the realm of professionals, doctors, lawyers, others, the Idaho statutes provide, and I'll paraphrase, that if you are a corporation or a limited liability company or a professional limited liability company, then you are responsible for the acts and omissions of anybody under acting under your direct control and authority. And there's no doubt from the record in the case that Jessica Schultz was acting as I'll use the word agent, although that may not be totally appropriate. She was acting on behalf of and under the control and supervision of Dr. McDonald throughout this whole scene at the hospital. And, you know, one thing that I feel badly that I didn't stress enough in the filings is that one of the best indications that Dr. McDonald is responsible for what she did and didn't do is the morning after everything went bad, Dr. McDonald came in and signed off on all the orders that Jessica Schultz had given the night before, some of which we believe were grossly inappropriate. And why did Dr. McDonald say he signed off on those orders, even though he had testified that he wished that maybe she would have called her or called him? He signed off because he said, because I'm responsible for what she did. So in addition to the statute, in addition to all the, I'll call them elements of what would create an employment relationship between Dr. McDonald or his company and Jessica Schultz, we also had the acknowledgement of that in the records, in the medical records, by Dr. McDonald saying he's responsible for it. So I hope that answers your question, Your Honor. It is not clear, and I wish I could say exactly who, for example, in her deposition, and this isn't in the brief, but I asked, who gave you your paycheck? You know, what person or company gave you your paycheck? And Jessica Schultz says, well, I don't know. I said, well, could you check records? And she said, well, no, I can't. We don't have records back that far. My husband takes care of all that. So I believe that we did what we could to try and find out exactly who the employer was. Could not do that and assert that both the statute and Dr. McDonald's actions, as well as other indicators, all show that Dr. McDonald was responsible for what Jessica Schultz did and did not do. Now, what did we do as plaintiffs and appellants? What did we do to demonstrate that our experts had actual knowledge of the local standard of care at Northwest Specialty Hospital? We had three principal expert witnesses engaged in this. We had Dr. Vernon Kubiak, who is a PhD nursing doctor who teaches nursing to people over in Pocatello at the university there, who then go throughout the entire state of Idaho. So Dr. Kubiak is well-versed in Idaho rules and regulations. We had Suzanne Nebaker, who is a nurse practitioner who practices in Salmon, a smaller hospital. And she is both a nurse practitioner and nurse, and once again, well acquainted with practice in Idaho. We went out of state for a hospital administrator. Timothy Hawkins is one of the better experts in that in the country. And we did that to demonstrate the concept that because Northwest Specialty Hospital is certified by CMS for Medicare or Medicaid matters. That in turn, that certification is dependent on a hospital or healthcare provider having rules and regulations and protocols in effect to provide for the safety of its patients. And the way most providers do that is by an affiliation with the Joint Commission, which used to be the Joint Commission on Hospital Accreditation or something like that. And so Northwest Specialty Hospital is accredited by the Joint Commission, and the Joint Commission rules and regulations are what define the standard of care that they have voluntarily undertaken at Northwest Specialty with respect to hospital administration. And so that has been explained in detail by Mr. Hawkins, and we went steps further than that. I'm gonna gloss over a bit. It's all in the briefs, summaries of Kubiak, Nebaker, both of whom who relied heavily on Idaho statutes and the Idaho Administrative Procedure Act, IDAP, and Idaho Nursing Rules and Regulations. All of those apply to every health care and every nurse in Idaho. And both Dr. Kubiak and Suzanne Nebaker went into great detail, which we lay out in our briefs, about not only why and how those Idaho rules and regulations apply, but also how they were violated in the care provided by the hospital and the nurses. Of key importance, too, in defining the local standard of care, from our perspective, was that both Dr. Kubiak and Suzanne Nebaker rely heavily on the standards of practice from the American Nursing Association. Those standards of practice were adopted in the internal documentation of Northwest Specialty Hospital as rules and regulations that should apply to nursing and hospital care provided. And those rules and regulations were acknowledged by testimony from some of the nurses at Northwest Specialty Hospital that, yes, we know the ANA, and yes, we knew that we were supposed to be in compliance with and provide our care in accordance with the American Nursing Association rules and regulations. So ultimately, we come down to the concepts that the court has faced before. I know it's not new. It's not the first rodeo in these kinds of cases. They come up, it seems like, every 3 or 4 months. But the concept of what is the local standard and how does the local standard relate in any way to national standards? And we find, of course, that in the most recent case you've decided on these issues, the Phillips case, that you want to reiterate, for example, that a physician who is board certified nationally, that is his standard of care, and that is the local standard of care for that physician in Idaho. And that's simply a restatement of two other older decisions that have been made by the court. I'm not aware that the court has gone so far as to say that national standards, such as the American Nurses Association standards, would be these standards in a vacuum. However, we are not dealing in a vacuum because those ANA standards of nursing practice have been acknowledged and adopted by the hospital for its nurses, and the nurses have testified as to familiarity with those standards and that they acknowledge that they were supposed to follow those standards. So,
Mr. Shockey,
yes.
Can you tell me what specific statutes, ANA policies, or IDAPA policies were violated in this case?
Yes, and those are detailed in our filings, Your Honor, and in our briefs. I can't from memory give you citations to the IDAPA provisions without thumbing through, but those exact provisions are cited in by, they're cited by our experts in their filings and also summarized in our briefs. So I'm going to ask for your forbearance, Judge, if I could. In my time off, I will get the exact citations to those. And also in our briefs, I will get to you some of the detailed analysis of what those standards were and how they were violated. The time that I have right now, what I'd like to address, I'm sorry. I thought maybe there was another question coming. Of course, there are a number of ways that an expert witness can demonstrate familiarity with the local standard of care. I'm sure that you all could recite them. The gold standard, so to speak, is talk to a local provider. It doesn't have to be within your own specialty necessarily. Otherwise, you can rely on depositions, you can rely on rules and regulations. And so in the course of the proceedings in the trial court, when we were dismissed the first time by the trial court on the grounds that we had not produced admissible evidence, and we would argue with that, of course. And in the course of those proceedings, it just became explicitly clear to me that we were being held to a standard by the trial court of, you've really got to get somebody local who can say what the standard of care is, and nothing else will do for us. So in our motions for reconsideration, our nurse practitioner, nursing expert, Suzanne Nebaker, actually talked to two nurses, nurse practitioners in the area. She reported that in her declaration. She reported that her conversations with those nurses confirmed that her view of the APA and ANA, I'm sorry, and other matters did define the local standard of care. There have been huge attacks on Suzanne Nebaker, which we contend are unfounded and inappropriate. And so our filings and her declarations detail exactly what she did, why she did it, and how she did it to confirm that her views of the local standards were the views that are actually applied in Post Falls, Idaho. Now, as I understand the trial court's ruling, the judge pretty much ignored or didn't incorporate any of the information that we provided on our motion for reconsideration, because the trial court felt that our motion for reconsideration was not appropriately filed. And to get to that conclusion, the trial court said that under rules 59 or 60, there would be issues with me considering new evidence. However, this isn't, our motion for reconsideration was filed under rule 11 of the rules of procedure. And both that rule and its interpretive decisions, specifically the Wickle case, which we've cited, make it pretty clear that that rule is separate and independent from the rule 59 and rule 60. And therefore, we assert that the trial judge should have considered all the additional evidence that we presented in our motion for reconsideration, just as though it had been presented initially. And alternatively, we assert that what we presented initially, especially in the absence of any evidence that would be admissible at trial of what the local standard of care was from the defense, we believe that we should have prevailed in the first instance, and that, of course, we're asking this court to overturn the trial court's rulings in both regards. and for this court to give due consideration to all the evidence before it. I know that my 20 minutes is up for now. I will get those citations for you, Justice Stegner, and cede my, I don't know what to say.
we'll turn it over to the respondent, sir. Yeah. Very good. On behalf of the respondents, who is going to go first?
Brother. This is for Dr. McDonald.
Correct.
Okay.
You may proceed, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court, I want to talk today about two issues that I think are revealed by the briefing. The first is whether on summary judgment, a defendant in a medical malpractice case has the burden of proof to show what the standard of healthcare practice is and that he complied with it before the burden shifts to the plaintiff to comply with Idaho Code Section 6-1012 and 1013 to produce evidence that would be admissible to trial to show that the defendant failed to comply with the standard of healthcare practice. I also want to talk about whether the complaint stated a claim against Dr. McDonald for vicarious liability and whether the court was proper in granting summary judgment on the complaint in behalf of Dr. McDonald because it didn't. First, on this burden of proof issue, I've read the Suhadolnik case at length, and I note that Suhadolnik relied on the Foster versus Trawl case. That was Justice Jim Jones' decision back in 2005. And in the Suhadolnik case, the court said that the moving party must support their summary judgment motion with evidence, but it is the adverse party that must come forward with specific facts to show or to support their claim. So if you go back and look at Foster versus Trawl at page 893, and I think that's the Pacific citation, cites to Delaney, Dunlap versus Garner, and McGilvray, quoting from Celotex, saying that it is proper for a defendant in a medical malpractice case to say that it is an essential element of the plaintiff's proof that the plaintiff show a violation of the standard of care under the familiarity rules that are set forth in 6-1012 and 6-1013. I've also reviewed Maddox. And Maddox says, we leave for another day the question of whether such an affidavit, that's a defendant's affidavit, is admissible evidence and sufficient to shift the burden of production to the plaintiff in a medical malpractice case. So against that background, defendant Dr. McDonald relied on Celotex, which I believe is still the law in Idaho, to say that it is an essential element of the plaintiff's case that they show that an expert who is critical of Dr. McDonald demonstrates that he or she has actual knowledge of the applicable standard of healthcare practice and that the defendant, Dr. McDonald, failed to comply with it. And then Eldridge comes out, Eldridge versus West, which is a decision that kind of looks like it goes both ways. And I say that not to disparage Justice Stegner in writing the decision, but it talks about first Dr. West's affidavit that the Supreme Court determined was conclusory and says, well, then because it's conclusory, it's inadmissible. And Dr. West's motion for summary judgment is denied. But then it goes on to talk about Turpin, who was the he was either a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant. I can't remember which one it was. But it then talks about that Turpin had filed an affidavit, but Turpin had also asserted as a basis for summary judgment that the plaintiff could not present admissible evidence against him that he violated the standard of healthcare practice. And so the Supreme Court granted Turpin's motion for summary judgment, saying if a plaintiff in a medical malpractice action fails to provide expert testimony evidence that the defendant negligently failed to meet the applicable standard of healthcare, the medical defendant is entitled to summary judgment, and cites Maddox. So if you go back to Foster versus Trawl, which is where this all started, Justice Jones wrote that the evidence requirement is not evidence that the defendant knows what the standard of care is, demonstrates what the standard of care is, or complied with the standard of care. It is just evidence that prompts the plaintiff to come forward with his burden of proof or her burden of proof that the defendant failed to meet the standard of care. So I think that Selitex is still good law, and that the plaintiffs here, the Fisks, saying that the defendant has to demonstrate what the standard of care is as a condition precedent to the defendant coming forward to satisfy the plaintiff's burden of proof is really asking the wrong question. Because if you read 610.12 and 610.13, the plaintiff's expert, whether he or she be a local or an out-of-state expert or out-of-area expert, need not say what the standard of care actually is. A revolutionary thought. The expert only need show that he can demonstrate that he or she has acquired actual knowledge of the standard of care and that the defendant failed to meet that standard. So it seems like the Fisk's request in this case that the defendant demonstrate what the standard of care is really asks the wrong question. And that's because the standard of care is not some platonic form out there in some perfect world that describes all the contours of what reasonable doctors of that specialty in that circumstance do. And in fact, when you get to trial, as Justice Stegner knows, because we have tried a case involving medical malpractice, there's often a healthy and robust debate at the time of the trial what the standard of care is and requires. So it really asks the wrong question, not what the standard of care is, but has the expert familiarized him or herself with the standard of care?
Your argument in my mind, and I need to clarify it, is that the defendant, physician, needs to come forward with evidence of the local standard of care, and then needs to be rebutted by the plaintiff in that regard. And as such, are conclusory statements that I did nothing more than meet the standard of care, is that in fact evidence?
If an affidavit is proffered by the defendant that I know what the standard of care is and I complied with it, I agree that's conclusory. And that's not evidence, okay? But that's not the issue. The issue is whether, and the issue was squarely put in Dr. McDonald's motion for summary judgment, whether the plaintiff could demonstrate that an expert had acquired actual knowledge of what the standard of care is, whatever it is, and that the defendant, Dr. McDonald, failed to comply with it. So that's the Selitex test, which is still good law in Idaho, that requires, it highlights for the plaintiff what the defendant feels is a deficiency in the plaintiff's case, as to which the plaintiff would have the burden of proof at trial and has the burden of proof on summary judgment, highlights that issue, and then it's up to the plaintiff to prove that the defendant violated the standard of care. And statements in Maddox, Sudolik, and other cases are simply dicta, because when you look at Foster, It says the requirement found in Idaho case law that a party moving for summary judgment present evidence is not a requirement that the party present specific facts, as Foster implies. Evidence and facts are related, but nonetheless different concepts. As a result, the summary judgment process imposes different requirements on a movement than those faced by the adverse party. Although the party moving for summary judgment must establish through evidence the absence of any genuine issue of material fact, there is no requirement that the movement present specific facts. And I think Eldridge can be read consistently with that, because if you challenge the plaintiff's proof as to which the plaintiff has the burden of proof at trial and would have the burden of proof on summary judgment, highlighting the absence of any sufficient evidence to meet the statutory requirements for admissibility of that testimony is a sufficient way to bring the issue for summary judgment before the court. And the trial court recognized that and granted summary judgment to McDonald. Now, nobody criticized Dr. McDonald. Nobody said Dr. McDonald violated any standard of healthcare practice, either at the time of his surgery or at the time of the events when Dr. McDonald discovered that Mrs. Fisk had a rigid belly, had mesenteric ischemia, and had diminished bowel sense. And he did exactly the right thing. He engaged Dr. Pennings to evaluate the patient and do a surgery on her. And the complaint itself does not say that Dr. McDonald did anything for which he was vicariously liable. It simply says that Dr. McDonald was negligent. With respect to Northwest Specialty Hospital, the plaintiff's complaint said that Northwest Specialty Hospital is liable for the acts and or omissions of its agents or employees, but there is no such allegation in the complaint against Dr. McDonald. The trial court, looking at Maroon versus Wireless, said, it's not pled. You can't use this as a basis for resisting a motion for summary judgment. Therefore, summary judgment is proper. Thereafter, which is a highlight of this, the plaintiff moved to amend the complaint. That motion to amend was denied. That's a proper exercise of the trial court's discretion. It's not contested. And the plaintiffs, the Fisks, have not raised that in their opening brief as an issue on appeal. Therefore, that is an accomplished fact that if this case were remanded for trial, there'd be it would be law of the case. So if there's no vicarious liability claim, no proof of negligence on the part of Dr. McDonald, and the court says the complaint containing its short and plain statement of the claim showing that the pleader is entitled to relief does not contain that claim, then that decision by the trial court ought to be sustained on appeal. And indeed, how much time do I have left?
1:59, sir.
And indeed, the Fisk did not rely on their argument that there was some insufficiency in Dr. McDonald's motion for summary judgment. They attempted to provide affidavit facts, which the trial court properly determined did not show that Dr. McDonald was liable for anything, did not show that they had pled and were prepared to prove that Dr. McDonald was responsible for Jessica Scholes. On reconsideration, the plaintiffs attempted, although they did not go back and try to establish some kind of agency or responsibility on Dr. McDonald for Jessica Scholes' acts or omissions, they simply returned to their discussions that Nebiger's affidavits were sufficient to show a violation of the standard of healthcare practice. But they never attempted, even though Nebiker's affidavits were filed after judgment, one filed well after the 14-day period that a motion for reconsideration would be brought or a motion to alter or amend a judgment under Rule 59. So they were brought within the 60B period. No attempt by the Fisks to show good cause why this could not be have been brought up earlier was ever made. And indeed, the trial court went on at length to discuss how the Fisks had the opportunity to either make a timely motion to amend or had the opportunity to fix their affidavits to demonstrate a violation of the standard of healthcare practice, did not do so with admissible evidence, and did not show good cause why the third declaration of Nebiger that detailed her conversations with nurse practitioners who did practice in the area could not have been made earlier. In the absence of good cause, the trial court was properly within the exercise of its sound discretion to reject those affidavits and to deny the motion for reconsideration.
Very well. Yeah, you're out of time.
Thank you.
Mr. Ramsden. Ms. Garrett?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think I'll jump around a little bit and try, oh, am I muted?
No, I can hear you.
Okay, all right, good.
Thank you.
I think I'll jump around a little bit and try to answer some of the questions that have to do with the plaintiff's arguments today. And I really certainly appreciate the justices giving us this time for oral argument. And I know that this is unfortunate times, but Mr. Ramsden and I, and of course, Mr. Shockey, believe that we can maybe offer some information that is beyond the briefs. One of the things that I think that unfolded in this case was who was Ms. Schultz, who is a nurse practitioner and can practice independently, who is responsible for her liability since the plaintiffs did not name her as a party in the case. At first, I believe that the plaintiffs believed that she was a physician's assistant. And a physician's assistant is licensed by and through a physician and must practice vis-a-vis a physician, and a physician must co-sign all orders, etc. So a physician's assistant, just like it sounds, comes directly off of a physician. And in this case, Ms. Schultz was not a physician's assistant. She was a nurse practitioner, duly licensed by the state of Idaho to practice. And she was practicing in a role in which she was on call that night that Mrs. Fisk became ill. She was on call for Dr. McDonald. And the nurses that were trying to keep Mrs. Fisk well were required to call Ms. Schultz for all direction as to what they could do to try to help Mrs. Fisk. In Ms. Nebiker's affidavits and in Dr. Kubiak's affidavits, they all show that the nurses called and called and called. There were about 6 to 7 calls to Ms. Schultz for help. And in fact, at one time, the nurse stepped outside the scope of her role and said, "Can we call a consultant? Can we get somebody else to help us?" And Ms. Schultz allowed them to do. Now, the procedures and the privileges at the hospital would have required Ms. Schultz to make that call. But Ms. Schultz didn't want to make that call. So the nurse, Colleen Miller, made that call to the intensivist that was on call for the hospital, saying and told the intensivist what was wrong with Mrs. Fisk. The intensivist said, here's my recommendation, transfer her immediately. The nurse called back to the nurse practitioner Schultz and said, the intensivist says, transfer her immediately. Ms. Schultz tells the nurse, do not transfer Mrs. Fisk. It is not the decision of the nurse or the hospital to not transfer Mrs. Fisk. Now, the plaintiffs tried to blur that fact in their brief, but the order came directly from Ms. Schultz, do not transfer Ms. Fisk. And instead, I want you to start on these certain items to get her ready for a scope, meaning an endoscope, to look down her throat and into her stomach to see what was going on. And so Ms. Schultz turned at that, prior to calling Ms. Schultz and getting a hold of her in between the call to the intensivist and the call to Ms. Schultz about the intensivist, all the nurses on the floor were preparing Mrs. Fisk for transfer. They were filling out the forms. They were getting her ready to go. They were calling people to line it up. So they were busy doing that. And then Ms. Schultz says, no, don't transfer. Keep the patient at the hospital. And we'll let our Dr. Pennings do the scope. And at that point, the nurses were told by Ms. Schultz, order these lab works, get her ready to go for the scope. I can't remember all the different things they were supposed to do. And so the nurses had to shift gears. And so at that point, it's probably about 3:30 in the morning, so to speak. And they expect the scope to go off somewhere early in the morning. But at no time, not one time, did Mrs. Schultz come in and help those nurses. Not one time did she come in and lay her hands on that patient, take a look at that patient, help the nurses decide what to do. It was the nurses that were calling out to her and telling her, we need your help. This is what's going on. The patient is in extreme pain, 10 out of 10. And the evidence of what Mrs. Schultz knows is that she has an iPad that's in real time. She can see the notations of the nurses. So this idea that the nurses didn't tell her anything is just not true. Not only did the nurses tell her, she could look on it in real time. So if you look at the evidence that they put forward, the plaintiffs put forward as to their expert witnesses, Dr. Kubiak is a professor, an assistant professor, the bottom of the rung, assistant professor at ISU. He practices in Arco, Idaho. Susan Nebaker is a nurse practitioner that practices in Salmon, Idaho. The local standard of care is probably known by at least 1,200 nurses in the Kootenai County area. There is three acute care hospitals there. Kootenai, another specialty hospital, and then the defendant. And there is no showing, not one single showing, that the plaintiff picked up the phone and called any nurse that was practicing in that county. That's not hard to do. The nurses are listed on a website with the Board of Nursing. There is plenty of ways to get a hold of a nurse, but they didn't try to. They didn't even make one attempt to do that. Instead, they read volumes of stuff and talk to each other and talk to people that were if you consider the last declaration, and it would be the third declaration, but the fourth report by Ms. Nebaker trying to correct her testimony to get it admissible. If you believe that, she talked to two nurse practitioners who are in a completely different class than nurses, and neither one of them practiced acute care at a hospital. Now, okay, so they don't practice at a hospital. They can tell her the standard of care on Schultz, according to some of your recent opinions, but they can't tell her the standard of care on a completely different class. And that's what occurred in the case of Eldridge. In Eldridge, there was a physician and a PA, a physician's assistant. They had evidence, the plaintiffs had evidence that the doctor violated the standard of care, but they didn't have evidence that a different class violated the standard of care. And a PA is closer to a doctor than is a nurse practitioner. A nurse practitioner can hang out her own shingle or his shingle. She can admit, discharge, make any order she wants, and no one has to co-sign her. And that, I'm certain, is why Dr. McDonald wanted a nurse practitioner to help him. But there's no evidence whatsoever that Ms. Nebaker or Dr. Kubiak made one attempt to find out actual knowledge of the local standard of care. And this is distinguishable with Perry. In Perry, that was a case where the only issue was where and how do you give an IM injection? That was it. And the experts looked at the only text that the nurses, the defendant nurses, said they used to understand and identify the correct standard of care. That's the only thing. And then they read their depositions in which they said, yes, we follow this text. I think it's kiosk or something. And so in that case, by reading that text and those depositions, and by the fact that this is a very concrete and limited issue, that the plaintiffs, it was found the plaintiffs could reach the level of actual knowledge of the standard of care. In this case, there was a lot going on, and there were a lot of actions. There were a lot of things that the nurses were doing, activities, and there's not one concrete, coherent item in either of Nebaker's or Kubiak's declarations, affidavits, reports, etc., that says what the nurses did wrong. There's not one place.
Adam, could I interrupt here with a question? Are you then basically saying that, yes, you're correct, there were numerous activities that took place until 3 a.m. in the morning when she was finally taken care of properly? Are you saying to this court that the plaintiff's burden is in fact that there has to be evidence on each and every communication, each and every action taken? Or are you saying there's just a dearth of evidence as concerns this entire time period?
Thank you, Your Honor, for the question, and thank you so I can clear that up. First of all, Mrs. Fisk was not taken care of at 3 a.m. like the nurses wanted her to. Mrs. Schultz stopped that transfer at 3 a.m. and Mrs. Fisk went on, and the nurses continued to try to meet her needs until 6 a.m. or 6 a.m. sort of. And then, no, what I'm saying as far as the activities, they haven't, Nebaker and Kubiak haven't said, what is it that the nurses did wrong? Did they not give Mrs. Fisk enough medication? Did they not, instead of calling Ms. Schultz six times, they should have called her 12 times? you know, they haven't given us a determined, concrete, coherent evidence as to what it is that they said they did wrong. In fact, Dr. Kubiak says it's one thing or another. If you believe the nurses that they called Schultz all this time and Schultz wouldn't come in, then the nurses met the standard care. If you believe Schultz's testimony that they didn't ever call her and never told her anything was wrong, then the nurses violated the standard of care. But if you believe the nurses, it was Schultz. If you believe Schultz, it was the nurses. So Kubiak's affidavit isn't admissible on many fronts, but you don't get to pick and choose. You've got to tell the court what is it that was the local standard of care and what is it that the defendant violated. You have to line those two up. You could violate the standard of care all day long, but if they do not identify what the local standard of care is and what part of it you violated, it's not admissible. And of course, then you go on to damages, and that's another thing. But
excuse me, at this time, your time is up.
You're kidding.
Yes.
Okay.
But yes, it is up. Well, and no, I'm not kidding.
Yeah, okay, sorry. Thank you. Thank you, Justice.
Thank you, Madam. On behalf of the appellant, Mr. Shockey, you have 9 minutes. Mr. Shockey, you are on mute. Unmute. There you go.
I didn't do that.
So, no problem. Okay. You may proceed.
Thank you. First, to address Justice Stegner's questions to me about the specific Idaho Code provisions and IDAPA provisions, on page 10 of our brief, in describing some of the opinions of Dr. Kubiak, we note that he relied on Idaho Code 18-1401 and 54-1404 and IDAPA, not section, but 23. Then for Suzanne Nebaker, she relies on the similar things and the Idaho IDAPA rules for the Board of Nursing, 400.01, 400.02, and those appear at page 17 of our brief, and the record references for that are record page 1631 to 1632. Turning first to the comments on behalf of Dr. McDonald, it is correct to say that we didn't say that Dr. McDonald violated any standard of care for the surgery. We know that Dr. McDonald wishes that Jessica Schultz would have called him in the middle of the night when things were going so haywire. And let me just back up and emphasize that just a little bit. She started getting bad in the midday or early afternoon, and she progressively got worse and worse and worse until the point, or you've heard it from Ms. Garrett's presentation, that the nurses were extraordinarily concerned about her condition. The nurses say they called Jessica Schultz multiple times. Jessica Schultz says, no, they didn't. Well, there is a factual dispute right there that is critical and central to the case that does not lend itself to a summary judgment determination. If the nurses And Dr. Kubiak must be honest and straightforward with the courts and say, if it's one way, then it was the nurse's fault. If it's another way, then it's Jessica Schultz's fault.
I understand that, sir, but it, and these are, I think we'll if we're not already, we're very familiar with the facts, irrespective of my misstatement to Ms. Garrett. The issue is, Shockey's not a party. Who does she work for? That was the issue that Ms. Garrett was bringing forward. The nurses who work for the hospital are great people. Shockey's at fault. Who does she work for? And how is that proven?
Schultz is the nurse practitioner who worked for Dr. McDonald, and in the brief and in my arguments, I've pointed out, you know, he paid for her insurance. He paid for her malpractice insurance. He, Dr. McDonald, had all the indicators of an employer-employee relationship.
So then it boils down to the issue of the motion to amend.
Well, it shouldn't have to. The motion to amend was filed simply to try and cure something that we didn't think was a problem. If the judge said, well, you didn't put it in your complaint, we wanted to put it into our complaint.
Why didn't you think it was a problem?
We didn't think it was a problem because by that time, we were well aware of the Idaho statute, which says that a professional like Dr. McDonald is responsible for everybody under his supervision and what they do. And you can't get away from that statute. That is a statutory responsibility assigned to him. And as I said earlier, he acknowledged ultimately his responsibility for what she did or didn't do by signing off on the orders she gave, including the order not to transfer Mrs. Fisk out of Northwest Specialty down to Kootenai, which could have made a big difference both in her bowel issues and in other associated issues that we haven't focused on a lot in the case. So what Dr. McDonald is really doing is asking you to ignore an Idaho statute that requires he is responsible.
So and you're talking about Idaho Code section 30-1306?
Yes.
And it says any officer, shareholder, agent, or employee of a corporation shall remain personally and fully liable and accountable for any negligent or wrongful acts or misconduct committed by him or any person under his direct supervision. So now I'm back to the question, is there a corporation, a neurosurgical corporation, that stands between McDonald and Schultz?
I think the statute says professional entity.
Employee of a corporation organized under this act.
Well, my version of the statute, and I admit that there might be differences in how they're recorded, but my version of the statute says employee of a professional entity, which there's no doubt that Dr. McDonald was a professional entity. We just don't know which one. And we tried to find that out and we couldn't.
But you haven't sued the corporate entity, have you?
We did not, because Dr. McDonald is personally responsible. It's just like I'm a lawyer in Wyoming. I have a PC, a professional corporation, but I remain personally liable for anything that I do wrong and anything that any of my employees do wrong while acting under my control and supervision. And I think that's the law in Idaho as well. And Dr. McDonald does not get any protection personally or professionally from his responsibility for what Jessica Schultz did. So let me turn quickly to some of the things that Ms. Garrett said. If you assume that there were 6 to 7 calls between the nurses and Jessica Schultz, and if you want to give the nurses the best light to that, then they knew there was a horrible problem and they had other things that they should have done. And this is in the affidavits of our experts. And particularly I want to reference Timothy Hawkins, the hospital administrator, who said that the hospital's rules and regulations were not adequate in giving nurses presented with that situation an ability to go over the head of the nurse practitioner and up to the higher ups in their entities, and the nurses, either because they didn't have those rules and protocols available or because they did and violated them, the nurses were negligent because they didn't go further than just calling Jessica Schultz.
Sir, you have 1 minute and 30 seconds.
All right. Another thing that I wanted to point out based on what Ms. Garrett said is that the nurse practitioner people that were consulted by Suzanne Nebaker, are nurses in the first instance, and then they go through more to become a nurse practitioner. And this court has said more than once on many occasions that to familiarize yourself with a local standard of care, you don't have to talk to a person in exactly the same specialty. And so for Suzanne Nebaker to talk to two nurse practitioners to, in response to filings by Ms. Garrett, I might add, to talk to two nurse practitioners to get the standard of care for both nurse practitioners and nurses, that practice has been acknowledged and accepted by this court. I'm sure my time's up. I appreciate the opportunity to have had these discussions with you, and thank you very much.
Okay. I appreciate counsel's indulgence in our new experiment. At this time, if counsel, if you would please leave the meeting, then the court will immediately go into a session and chat about this issue. Carol, should I initiate a new Zoom meeting?
You should, because there will be other people who could hear your conversation.
Very good. At this time, justices, thank you to counsel. We would shake your hand, but here's an elbow.
All right, here's my elbow.
All right. See you later, folks.
Yes. How we leave?
I will end the meeting.
All right.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you. At this time, I'll initiate a new meeting with the justices. Thank you very much, one and all.
Signing off.